Jo, welcome to OTT Talks.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
Okay, well, first of all, congratulations on your new book, Screens, Research and Hypertext. I'm very excited to have this conversation with you. I've been following your writing on this topic for a little while. I think in 2020, you published an article on OTT and called Research Isn't Linear, So Why Are Reports? And as you know, at OTT, we've done some experimenting with non-linear reports in some of our projects. And now we have this fuller exploration of non-linear writing and reading. But I want to start by asking you, for those who haven't been with you on this journey, can you tell us a little bit more about what do we mean by non-linear writing and hypertext?
Sure. So first, thanks for the nice introduction and for the congratulations. So I've also been following the work that you've been doing on this front, and it's been really fascinating stuff. So it's very cool to see you, kind of trying out new things and, you know, being able to get folks on board with trying out those new things for them. So congratulations as well. So what do we mean by nonlinear stuff? So it's a really good question. It's in some ways easier to talk about what it's not. So a kind of linear text is the normal sort of thing you get where, you know, you have one paragraph above the next, above the next, above the next, and kind of each one sort of builds on the last one so that you get over the course of the whole thing, you get either a story that unfolds sequentially, or you get an argument that builds sequentially. A nonlinear text would, kind of throws all of that out. So instead of, instead of this thing where you've got, a paragraph above it, the next one above the next one, you might take a little section and you put it on one screen, and then you have another section that is on a whole different screen, and a third section on a whole different screen. And when people get to the end of the first one, you give them a choice between which things you want to read next. So it's kind of like the like those old fashioned choose your own adventure books that I sometimes read as a kid, but done in kind of with hyperlinks rather than with flipped page 400 or flipped to page 80 kind of thing.
Great. Yeah, I really like this quote from your book where you say the web has transformed how we consume information, but it's done remarkably little to change how we produce it, and that perhaps there's a missed opportunity here. It feels like a very radical idea to me. I think what you're doing is challenging some really deeply ingrained ways of working, thinking in the research sector. So I want to kind of dig into that a little bit and see what it means in practice. So first of all, from the author's perspective, you talk in the book about the non-linear approach, meaning giving up a certain degree of control, right?
Yeah. So it's control, but it's arguably that control has always been a little bit of an illusion. So back in the 60s, I think, a literary theorist, sorry, I'm going to get really geeky here for a minute, so just throw something at me if I should stop. But a literary theorist by the name of Roland Barthes wrote this kind of what has since become, at least in academic terms, a kind of famous essay called The Death of the Author. And so you'll see this idea thrown around sometimes, and in his context, it was really meant to be about how we interpret texts, and there had always been this sort of emphasis on the author's biography, the author's experiences, the author's intentions as being the kind of the primary way for interpreting a given text. Barthes argued that it was the kind of the wrong way around, and that what really matters in interpreting a text is what the reader takes away from the text, that it's not really about what the author intended, it's what the reader gets out of it. Barthes has become pretty famous in some ways the kind of the patron saint of people talking about hypertext, because what hypertext did is really take that idea and in some ways make it literal by sort of severing that sense of control of the author, saying here's how the story should be told, and really flipping it around so that the reader is in charge of how the story gets told. So that's arguably it's the way people have always been reading texts, but it's not the way that authors have been thinking about approaching texts. It feels like you're in control of the text when you're the person who is writing a traditional linear document.
That's really interesting. So it's flipping it from thinking about the author's experience to thinking about the reader's experience. And what we're doing with nonlinear writing is facilitating them to experience it in a different way. And I really like the art exhibition analogy that you use in the book. So if you think about our research as being an art exhibit, every visitor will take a different journey through that exhibition, stopping at the paintings that are interesting to them. And then each visitor leaves having had a unique experience and drawing their own conclusions from that. So that's really interesting. But something that occurs to me as a research communicator who's spent a lot of their career trying to organize a lot of text in a very linear way to make it make sense for what we're constantly told, busy readers who don't have time we need to tell them in a short, concise way, this is what you should think and do. And there's no questioning that we know that people learning is deeper, it's more meaningful when people are active participants in it and when they're able to come to conclusions themselves. But then this goes against this way of thinking in the research sector about needing to kind of spoon feed people recommendations, etc. Do you think policy audiences have time for a nonlinear reading, or is it not about time? Is it? Yeah, do you know what I'm trying to say here?
Yeah, yes. So I think there are a couple of things. It's a really good point. And I think it's a fair one that it's hard to imagine any, you know, sort of a member of Congress sitting down and saying, I'm going to spend the next, you know, hour poking around this choose your own adventure-y sort of thing to find what I'm looking for. But I think you could say the same thing about the big honking report that comes out at the end of a lot of research projects too. So what I have in mind is less a replacement for every sort of research communications and more a replacement for those big reports. So it's a way of, I think, a better way of doing that sort of long form, we need to give you all the all the information needs to be included. I think it's a better way of presenting that, in part because it breaks that sort of thing down into a more modular way. So you can point to a specific bit that answers a specific question without needing to dig through an 80-page PDF to find that particular bit. But I don't think it's going to make obsolete the sort of work that you do day in and day out, where you say, in addition to the big thing, we also need the blog posts and the infographics and the, you know, the tweets and so forth. So it's not a sort of one size fits all replacement, but I think it is a replacement for the big main output that we often think of as the thing that research produces. Wrongly, yeah. Think that is the thing, but you know.
I have to say, when I was reading through the book from an author's perspective, there is certainly this idea of relinquishing some control, but I also find the idea quite liberating as well. You know, again, in this kind of role that I play as a research communicator, taking a lot of content and trying to sometimes force that into a linear narrative, there's so many ways you could piece it together, and actually it feels quite liberating to think we can just take a collection of ideas or questions and piece them together in a non-linear way rather than trying to find the perfect kind of line. But I'll admit that from a reader's perspective, when I started reading the book, and I did start reading it on my phone, on my cell phone, which I know later you recommend not doing. But I found it quite uncomfortable to start with, because I found myself thinking, what if I'm going to miss something really important? How do I know how much more there is to read? And I still don't know that I've actually read everything. And maybe that's, you know, not important. But the art gallery analogy helped me. But I was wondering, like, how much is this about needing to retrain ourselves in terms of how we read or how we think about research output?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some retraining. I think there's some being, I talk at one point about Pierre Baird's book, How to Talk About Books You Haven't Read, which is a sort of a cheeky title for a book. But one of the points that he's making throughout is that there is no sort of set meaning of to read a thing that one of the things that really, really stuck with me from his book is that every act of reading is equally an act of starting to forget. So, you know, by the time you have gotten through the first bit, especially if it's a thing that takes you, you know, a couple of weeks to go through, you've forgotten a lot of the details at the beginning of the book. So I think we tend to think of reading as just the straightforward thing where I start here and I finish here and then I have read it. But if I have read a thing and have forgotten three quarters of it, is that really any different from somebody who just skimmed the thing in the first place? So I think some of it is just sort of being more conscious of our relationship with what it really means to talk about having read a thing in the even in the first place, but I do think there's a certain extent to which when we're doing research in particular, we already read in this very disjointed sort of way. That, you know, I talk about my own process of starting to do the research for this book. I started by picking up a book on sort of digital rhetoric and started reading through it, and then realized that I had forgotten everything that I actually thought I knew about rhetoric. So I just kind of stop and go back, and I, you know, reread Aristotle and Cicero to remember what is rhetoric in the first place. And then I came back and got a little deeper and realized there's all this talk about various literary theorists, and I had no idea who they were. So I had to stop and go look them up and sort of get some more background to come back to the book. So I think there's always this sense in which research is this sort of kind of nonlinear process where we get sidetracked, we get derailed, we dive really deeply into something, then we pull back to where we were before. So the difference is that we don't usually have that experience within a single text. We're usually using multiple texts when we read this way. And so what we're really doing is sort of applying that way to a thing that's meant to be a unitary text.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think one of the things I like is that your book in itself is kind of challenging a lot of preconceptions we have about, for example, what is a book? Usually, you know, a book, we would say it has a front cover, a back cover, beginning, middle, and end. So in itself, it's a living example of rethinking these traditional formats. And I do think that in research, we have a lot of format hierarchy, right? You know, in terms, especially what's counted as evidence, citations, there are peer-reviewed journal articles, you know, if something's in a formal PDF, then it has perhaps more weight than an online article. So again, I think, you know, is this about just challenging a lot of these existing hierarchies? I was wondering, do we need to set up the first non-linear peer-reviewed journal where journal articles are all a non-linear experience, but they're peer-reviewed and they you know, live up to the rigor of what we're used to when we think of an article?
It's really interesting, and I will say it gives me I'm now having kind of a little bit of a horror trying to imagine being a peer reviewer and given a nonlinear thing and saying, go tell me how to, like, I would have no idea how to peer review that, to be honest. But yeah, I think that's a really excellent point, and it's certainly the case that in the research community there's definitely a hierarchy, and it goes not just to, you know, in terms of thinking about what we produce, but it goes into questions about, you know, like hiring, even, like, you know, you've written a book, that counts for more than if you've written, you know, some reports. So it definitely requires a kind of a rethinking of what our relationship is to outputs and what count as, you know, sort of serious important outputs and what doesn't.
Before we close, I wanted to ask you about what think tanks today can, how they can practically apply some of this. I know in the last article you published before the book, you were talking about research first reports potentially being an oxymoron, and that they're actually more of a stopgap until we figure out a better way to do this. So what can we do today? If an organization is kind of convinced and thinking we want to go non-linear, what are some of the tools or ways that we can start to put this into practice, do you think?
That's a really good question. And I spent nearly as long on the book trying to figure out how to put it together as I did actually writing the text that went into it. There aren't great tools for doing this at the moment. We're starting to get some that are a little better. It definitely starts, and this isn't going to surprise anybody who's known me, it starts by sort of getting rid of things that are based around a kind of a document metaphor to start with. So, you know, software is generally, developers like to call it opinionated. You open up Microsoft Word and you get a thing that looks like a sheet of paper. You can make Word do things that aren't producing stuff that you can print out on an office printer, but you're kind of fighting with it the whole time because its opinion is that you should be writing a document on this in this particular thing. So it starts with I think looking for tools that have different opinions built into the into them as a starting point. So things like Notion and Obsidian, Rome Research, which is what I used to ultimately use to kind of put together the book. These start with a kind of a different metaphor that really works more at the level of a block. So a piece of content, instead of being a document, is every time you hit the return key, it creates kind of a new piece of content that is addressable. So you can actually reference that specific block. You can add it to other things. So it's a way of treating each idea as its own unique piece of content, rather than treating a kind of a whole document as a piece of content. So there are lots of tools like this. It's largely a matter of preference as to which of those that you you can kind of play around with them and see which ones you like. People get really strong feelings about these things. My feeling is largely, if you're not working in Microsoft Word, you're already way ahead of the game. So do that.
Right. And just my final question: are there some cases where a PDF is just the best output?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, right now, given the state of the state of the web, if you're going to still produce a sort of a long linear document, as much as I'm the guy who rails against PDFs, if I need to read a thing and really seriously engage with it, it's easier to do that by printing out a PDF so I can scribble in the margins and stuff than it is to do it on a screen. And this, I think, is really, in a lot of ways, a failure of the web to make this easier to do. But it's really hard to annotate stuff on the web. So if what you're doing is producing a kind of traditional document, then yeah, PDF honestly may be, in a lot of cases, the better way to do things. Certainly, if if you're trying to get it in the hands of researchers, then yeah, I mean, it's still, for a lot of us, it's still a lot easier to print a thing out and make scribbles on a thing than it is to try and try and deal with it online.
Yeah. Okay, so we need to be investing in rethinking the infrastructure and ways that we, the ways that we work and the tools we have to help us to do this. Great. Okay, well, thank you so much, Jo. It's been a really fascinating conversation, and we're looking forward to continuing to try out some of these ideas, and we'll share our learning as well as we do that, and looking forward to see what comes next.
Fantastic. Thanks again for having me. This was a lot of fun.